I'm done, right? That's all. Okay. So, I'm going to try to stay close. You can hear me okay? Yes? I try to stay close so you can hear me. But I might get excited and someone might have to remind me. So, I'm very excited to be here again for the fifth API Days. And especially enjoying this topic very much, chats, bots, the future. And I come with a talk that I hope you will find interesting and thought-provoking. This is something that I've been thinking on for the last few years, and I wanted to bring it to you because I thought this would be the group where I could begin this discussion. So the name, Coming to Terms with Our Autonomic Future. We'll talk about that in a minute. There's actually a sort of a subtitle to this talk, and that is If We Dare. And this is based on the notion that I talk to many people, and I think there's something going on in our community, in our business, in our world, in our technology space, that means that we have to dare to discuss something that might make us a little uncomfortable. So I want to do that. That's one of the things I want to do today. But before that, I want to give you a little bit of backstory and why I bring this talk to you today. So a few years ago, I was in Silicon Valley talking to another person, a very influential person in this API space, in the space that we work in. And I made the comment, sort of in passing, that one of the things that concerns me a little is that one of my tasks is to help other companies get rid of jobs, get rid of people. Whether it's the company directly or the technology that they build that will remove jobs from the market space. And this makes me a bit nervous. Now, I was assured instantly, oh, you needn't worry, that's okay, everything will work out fine. But there's something that bothers me about that. I'm not sure that's really true. In fact, I think a lot of things that we're experiencing today in community in general, in society, in economy, in politics, relates to the role that technology is playing in our lives. And in fact, Stephen Hawking said so much as this just a few weeks ago in an op-ed in The Guardian, where he basically said, we can't go on ignoring what's going on around us. And in fact, we are somewhat responsible for its condition. His comment was that the automation of factories has already killed a huge sector of economy over the last half century, and now we're going to have to deal with more of it as artificial intelligence appears as well. And that's our work, that's what we do. I think that kind of makes us part of the challenge. In fact, what we found in the last 10 years is suddenly this change in the way the economy works. We now can gain more productivity without adding jobs. And this is not a bug in the system. This is actually a feature. This is the way it's going to be. We've gone through some of this before, and we're experiencing this again. This chart, by the way, is from a book Brynjolfsson and McAfee, who are working at MIT. This book is called The Second Machine Age, and they have a very interesting idea that we are starting what's called the Second Machine Age. The First Machine Age happened when we suddenly figured out how we could go beyond our muscles, how we could use energy, coal, oil, gasoline. We could suddenly change the equation, and we beat this what's called the Malthusian trap, this idea that the world can only hold so many people, can only support so many people. So suddenly this energy economy begins, and that begins the first set of machines. But now we're in the second machine age, and that's where we can figure out how to go beyond our brains. And that's the work that we are doing. We're multiplying our brain power, and we can commoditize and sell and create an economy about brains. So why is it my friend from Silicon Valley 2 years ago was thinking it's not a problem? Actually, many people think it's not a problem. If we could just get more jobs, if we could just get less unemployment, if we could just get more distribution of wealth. But I think it's a bit more than that, and I want to get to that in just a minute. I also want to explain the word autonomic in the title instead of autonomous or automatic or automated. So you may recognize the word autonomic from the autonomic nervous system. We all have this system in our body where there are all sorts of things that are automatically controlled for us, our breathing, our rate of respiration, our heart rate, all sorts of things, kidneys, all these other things. And they're managed without us. So they say unconsciously, but actually it's without our control. And it turns out that it's a bit complicated. It turns out this autonomic system responds to things around us, and that's called the flight or fight response. But it's not just all the story. There's also the rest and digest. There's the other side of the coin that helps us rest, helps us relax, helps us dilate our pupils and so on and so forth. And this creates this this system where there's actually this homeostasis, this idea that there's a balance involved. So balance is very, very important. And I think right now we're a little out of balance. And I think we'll get back to this. Okay. So let's look at the first one. The idea that we have these irrational fears about technology in our society. And some of us know people who are like this, that don't understand what's going on, that don't understand the world. We're worried about the rule of robots, that robots will take over our lives in various ways. And in fact, this idea of robot is a kind of an interesting story. Just recently, I think it was about a year ago, Stephen Hawking, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, they all warned us about this onslaught of robots, of how artificial intelligence, as Elon Musk put it, was an existential threat to humanity. It's really drummed up a lot of excitement. The word robot actually comes from an author, Karel Čapek, in this play, Rossum's Universal Robots. He's a Czech playwright, and Rossum's is actually a play on the word reason in Czech. And robots is a word invented very close to a Czech word called robota, which loosely translated means indentured servant or someone forced to do labor. And this is where we get the word robot. And robot enters the lexicon through Karel Čapek. Karel has written a lot of material. RUR, this play, is probably the best known. He's got several others. By the way, he was also nominated for a Nobel for literature 7 times. Never won. I'm not sure how that works. I don't know who's nominating him. In his play, I won't ruin the whole thing, but in his play, they figure out how to create robots, and robots begin to do all the work for humans, and the value of labor goes to zero. And in fact, what happens is the robots rise up and create a revolution and kill all of humanity. That's not the end of the play. So this idea that these robots would completely decimate culture and society and value and then overtake the world starts from this 1920s play. Now, there's another story that I rather like. It's a British story. It's called the Forbin Project. And this is a early 1970s movie. And it features this idea that in the Cold War age, we build these giant thinking machines that are hidden inside mountains. And the one we build is called Colossus. And it turns out it's going to manage all of our nuclear weapons and make sure a human doesn't make a mistake. Colossus discovers that the Soviets have also built a giant computer. It turns out the two computers get together, cooperate, and dominate mankind. At least we didn't die this time. Finally, the ultimate scare tale, right? James Cameron's version of Frankenstein, basically. This is the idea, right? The drones, Skynet drones, send a machine back into the past, our present, in order to murder the possible human that will cause the human uprising. It's reverse of Čapek. Now the machines rule the world, and we're going to make sure the humans don't rise up. But all of these things play on our fears. All these remind us of things. And what do they remind us? Things that we don't understand. How do they work? How does this part of the society work? How does technology work? We all know people who deal with this very experience. I don't understand this technology. Family, friends, neighbors, politicians, all sorts of people who don't understand how technology works. In fact, Japan, who works a lot on robots, have specifically focused on trying to create cute or friendly robots that we feel good about. It's a very important aspect of Asimo and a lot of other projects they do. They also create some rather creepy looking robots that are just not quite human, and it kind of freaks people out a little bit. Now, finally on this topic, Isaac Asimov, great science writer, had read Rossum's Robots, and he was really upset at this notion that robots were always killing us. So he specifically set out in the 40s to create a kind of system where robots could be trusted and be friendly. And he worked very hard to even create a series of sort of axiomatic laws that could assure readers that in the future, robots couldn't be built that would hurt us. And he called them the three laws of robotics, and released a whole series of short stories, and movies have been made based on these short stories. And this is sort of meant to assure us. And he thought, we have to get used to this notion that we will have robots, because they will exist no matter what we do. So despite the fears, despite all these things, we need to get beyond this, and we need to think more about the role that technology plays. Should we be afraid of robots? The short answer is no. But what they cause, the effects, we need to pay attention to. So that sort of leads us to the second part of the conversation, and that is what I would probably characterize as wild enthusiasm. Everyone gets excited about the notion of robots and automation in the future, and for good reason. There's another part of us, just like that part that's worried about us, there's another part of us that loves the future, that's romantic about the possibilities. In fact, in one of the characters in Chapek's play, explains that in the future, once robots are doing all the work for us, everybody will live only to perfect themselves, to do whatever you like, whenever you like, however you would like it, without worry for want or food or clothing or anything. And doesn't that sound nice? I mean, that sounds very nice. In fact, we know a relatively large class of people who actually operate on that idea. They work in this world where they don't have to worry about anything and they can do what they like. Now, I grew up as a child of the space age. I was given a lot of promises. I was told that there'd be flying cars and jetpacks and lots of leisure time. And, you know, it hasn't really worked out that way. In fact, we were always shown pictures in the 60s and even into the 70s about this amazing future where there was lots of travel and lots of things, neat things in the home and so on and so forth. But you know, as I worked through this material, I had a terrible time finding any examples of what work would look like. It's almost as if people understood work would not be so important, or possibly that work would not look very good. Now, I did find this one, which I thought was pretty good. You may have a difficulty telling what this is, but this is a farmer. If you look carefully, the north section and the south section and the weather and the milking machine and all these other things, this is what future farming could look like. I love that he's wearing some hat. There's something going on with the head there. I found a wonderful video called Leave It to Rollo, which is this video from the late 40s, sort of explaining what automation and technology would be. And you can see on the left the housewife with the helpful robot. Because we used to say back in the middle of the century, robot, not robot, but robot. And what I love that this robot is actually just helping around the house. What I love even more is there's this push button set of things that get done. Here's what I love. Don't we love the notion of one button? One button deploy. One button test, one button build. We know this idea perfectly, right? We would just need to change the names a little bit, and this is exactly what we're trying to build today, right? Now, there are also people building some amazing things today, not just imagined things from the 40s. I met a group of people at a company called Zipline. Has anyone heard of Zipline before? This is an amazing organization. Zipline builds drones and programs drones to deliver medicine and blood in places where automobiles can't go, saving people's lives, changing their lives in fundamental ways. In fact, based on what they're doing and the range of their drone, they've set up in Rwanda, where they can fly to almost anywhere in Rwanda in a matter of minutes, of like 30 minutes, and drop a supply of medical supplies. During the rainy season, even if it's only just a few kilometers away, sometimes cars can't get to someone if they're sick, if they're hemorrhaging. If they've had a difficult birth and they die. Now we have drones solving this problem. And this is a great team based in San Francisco. It's a small group. These drones are not delivering beer or pizza. They're actually delivering medical supplies that change people's lives in a fundamental way. There are lots of things to be excited about. There are so many more, but I just don't have time to talk to you about all of them. So I wanted to pick them. Now I want to go back to the Rollo story, because I love this part of the Rollo story. Rollo's story actually explains how many robots we have in our lives, even in the 40s. The automatic sprinkler robot, the robot in the plane that makes sure that we don't crash, the robot in the car that makes sure that the carburetor works properly or that the brakes or the steering works properly, the robot that feeds your pet. We have to remember that these are all robots. These are all technology. There are all sorts of pieces all over our lives. Often we don't think about them, but we have robots doing all sorts of things for us right now, even this one little clicker device, this magical thing. And you can ask questions. Do we depend too much on technology? And obviously some people online thought so. You can actually join this discussion at debate.org if you like. But when people are saying, yes, we're kind of dependent, I'm not sure if they were thinking of automatic lane assist on your car, or if they were thinking about the variable speed cruise control that actually matches speed with the rest of the traffic that you can get on cars today, or even the phone in your pocket that will reroute you based on what it determines is happening up ahead. These are all robots that we use every day. These are all robots that are an important part of our life. So that's cool, right? We're good. Everything's going great. That leads me to the last step. And that is the idea that there are some daunting realities to the kinds of technology we're building. And we need to talk about them. So there's this part in the, there's this notion in the play where somebody explains, you know, things could go bad. And the main character says, yes, but that cannot be avoided. And this is where part of the play really hinges. Now, there's this great book called The End of Work from Jeremy Rifkin, 1995. This is a 20-year-old book. And he lays out what the future is going to be like and how jobs are going to change in a fundamental way. Even better, he lays out the last 100 years to help you understand it. Here's one example from the last 100 years. Actually, I went a little bit further back. In 1890, in the United States, 75% of the labor jobs were farm-related. 75%. 50% by the half century, by 1900, 33%, and by the year 2000, less than 3% of the labor force was related to farming in the United States. And yet we had orders of magnitude more food, so much food, we had to install price support systems because we had done what? We had driven the cost of food towards zero. So we had to create a little cartel in the U.S. to keep the farm prices up. Now, farmers aren't the only ones that have experienced this within the last 100 years. I love this category from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, operatives. What are operatives? Drivers, manufacturing production, miners. Why are they called operatives? Because they actually tend the machine that does the work. They don't do the work anymore. They tend the machine. And notice how they've cut in half. Notice there's one bright spot, however, in that picture. There's one category that's gone up in the last 100 years. Drivers. Interesting. How about clerical workers? They experienced this huge boom when we first started to automate everything after the war, but notice as soon as we get to 1970, 1980, it starts to taper off. The computer comes in. There's all sorts of things that have to change. In fact, if you look more closely, you take away just the big number and you look specifically at individual things like stenographers and bookkeepers and telephone operators and bank tellers. Bank tellers have gone to zero. But there's one category that's grown. What category is that? Cashiers. So what Jeremy Rifkin tells us is that we're on this fundamental edge where things are going to change, just the same kind of talk that Brynjolfsson and McAfee talk about. But he says we are going to need fewer workers. That's a feature. And we need to get ready for that. And a lot of what we do is get rid of the need for future workers. We are part of doing this. So think about this. At the turn of the century, when Rossum's robots is murdering the planet and decimating all of society, farming falls apart. When the Guardian and the Colossus are planning to make all of the leaders of the world impotent, all of a sudden manufacturing is done. Robots do everything and people just sit around in their unions. When the machine comes back to kill off the future leader, businesses, corporations are terminating clerical workers, middle managers, stenographers, all sorts of people, replacing them with email spreadsheets and PCs. And that's all happened in the last 100 years. Most of it speeding up in the last 50. We already knew about this 20 years ago. So what does he say about the future? Well, it's really hard to tell, but let's look at just a couple of things. I looked up some labor statistics. Here are the statistics for the long-haul trucking driver. This is not just the local. This is the ones on the major roads. Almost 2 million people, $40,000 a year is a pretty good wage in the United States. It's above the poverty line. It's pretty darn good. Of course, just this year, Otto announced that they were going to do what? They're going to retrofit existing trucks with driverless technology. All told, that amounts to 3.5 million people who will be affected, most of them out of their job completely within the next 5 to 10 years. How about cashiers? Cashiers are pretty rough. In the US, that's below a living wage. But there are 3.5 million of them, not even counting the indirects. And what was just announced in the last week? Amazon's going to create stores that don't need cashiers. And they have this nice explanation about how cool this is going to be. So I just talked about as many as 10 million primary and secondary jobs, just in these two categories. And there are many more categories than that. Citigroup and Oxford have released a study that says over the next two decades, over the next 50 years, these are the percentages of jobs that could likely be replaced by machine. 77% of China's jobs, 85% of Ethiopia's, 47% of the US, 35% of the UK. That's huge. That's huge. And that's what we're doing. One factory alone in China has reduced their workforce by 50% with robots. We used to think that China was cheap enough that, you know, that wouldn't happen. It's happening. All right, so what does this all mean? What do we do? Do we stop it? Let's go to Nick Hanauer. Nick Hanauer is famous in the US. He was one of the first investors in Amazon. He's written several books. He's sort of an investor that gets involved in politics. And he's sort of the architect of the living wage. What does he say? I see pitchforks in our future when he talks about the so-called elite. He's talking the same way that Hawking was talking about. The thing is, we own it. We created the economy. We create the society. We create the politics. We create the wage levels. We create all of this. We own it. And as Werner Vogels at Amazon says, you build it, you run it. We're responsible. We can make choices. We can do things to make things different. So what do? We need to get past the irrational fear of technology expansion. And that's not just ours, it's everyone's. We need to help people figure that out. We used to spend a great deal of money in society helping people figure out what the future would be like so they'd be comfortable. I don't think we're doing that as much anymore. We need to recognize all the robots around us and realize that they're already a part of our lives and take advantage of them. We need to stop thinking about, we need to separate jobs from work. We may not have jobs, but everyone is going to want to work. That's what entrepreneurs do. That's what all sorts of people do. We can create all sorts of things where we can have microloans and all sorts of things where anyone can start a project anywhere, and they can be very localized. They can be microservices of bike repair and auto repair and all these things just local. They don't have to be massive Walmart investments. And we need to figure out how to stop measuring the progress by the employment rate, because the employment rate is continuing to drop, and it will continue to drop while productivity goes up. We need to start changing the way people talk about this and think about this. And we need to also be mindful of the effects of technology. Grady Boosh, for example, the person who is credited with being the father of UML, just last week said, maybe we need a carbon tax for robots. If your technology puts a lot of people out of work, maybe you're on the hook for a little bit of cost involved. Get involved in projects that improve people's lives. There are lots and lots of projects that you can get involved in that will fundamentally change the quality of life for millions of people. And consider working on the big problems. The big problem is not delivering beer. The big problem is figuring this out. The big problem is not getting the thing to build faster or with less bugs. Those are not big problems. This is a big problem. And think of the problem as autonomic. Think about both sides. When you create something, what are the effects? What is the other constraint you need? We're systems thinkers, right? We're developers. There's all sorts of technology on autonomic computer systems, things that can help balance things out. Use this design in designing everything, in designing our society, designing our community, designing our economics, even our politics. The biggest autonomic system that we know of is the planet we live on, and we can learn a lot, and we have lots of opportunity. It's an incredibly resilient system, but it is finite. So, no matter what fears you have, no matter how enthusiastic you are about anything, it's important to face the realities ahead of us. And how do we do that? Jeremy Rifkin says, people make history. We make it, we own it, we build it, we're in charge. And that means, as long as we come to terms with what that means and where we're going, we're going to have a great future. Thank you very much.